The Guardian.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
Welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Charles Arthur, sitting in for Alex Kratosky, who is seeking serendipity with an engine. That means just us boys. So I can do it in the style of Jeremy Clarkson. Or possibly not. On the show this week, we have a rare glimpse under the hood at Google as I talk to the head of Google Search, Amit Singhal. And Google is back in the headlines as its takeover bid for Motorola Mobility gets the regulatory thumbs up in China. I'll be talking to patents expert and technology blogger Florian Mueller on what this means for the patent wars. Also, as technology becomes more and more important to activists and activism around the world, we take a look at a tech-savvy NGO, that's a non-governmental organisation, called Tactical Tech. And Keith Stewart, the Guardian's answer to James May and Richard Haband combined, joins me in the studio to discuss this week's news, including a technical hitch with Blizzard's launch of Diablo 3. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. This week, Google had some good news to distract its chiefs from looking over their shoulders at Facebook's IPO. China has finally approved Google's $12.5 billion acquisition of the US phone and set-top box maker Motorola Mobility. It's going to be Google's largest takeover ever and gives it access to a portfolio of thousands of patents of the Android phone maker. To look into the machinations of this deal and its possible consequences, I spoke to patents expert and tech blogger Florian Mueller, who, we should point out, has consultancy contracts with Microsoft and Oracle. He spoke on the line from his native Germany, and I started out by asking Florian about the conditions that were set down by the Chinese when they okayed the takeover.
The conditions really aren't known in detail. What the Chinese regulators have said is that they want Google to continue to make Android available on free and open terms. So for the next 5 years, that is what Google has committed to do for 5 years. And there's also an issue there about so-called lead devices, meaning devices that flagship devices for new versions of Android. And the Chinese regulators were also very interested in ensuring that all device makers, or at least many of them, would have an opportunity to build such lead devices, because otherwise, simply by being first to market, some companies that are Google's preferred partners, which might be Motorola all the time at some point, would have a major strategic advantage.
So I guess the Chinese government, in wanting Android to be free and open for the next 5 years, which is pretty much double its life so far, they're looking to protect a lot of their handset makers.
I guess that was probably a big part of the motivation, but they also want to protect their local market, because regardless of who the handset makers are, one thing that is important about Android being available to Chinese companies on free and open source terms is that they want to be able, for example, to replace Google's search engine and other services with those services that Chinese consumers have a clear preference for. They use a different search engine primarily, named Baidu. They have other social networks, other email services, and I guess that was probably also part of the consideration.
Now, in acquiring MMI, which is expected to close this week, Google is getting a fair amount of litigation as well on its plate that Motorola is undertaking. Do you want to give a sort of sketch out the landscape there?
Yeah, Google is effectively buying itself into pending litigation, into ongoing litigation with Apple and Microsoft. Motorola is the only Android device maker to be embroiled in litigation with Microsoft at this stage, and they've also been suing Apple and vice versa for more than a year and a half. On both sides of the Atlantic, in fact, there are cases pending, mostly in the United States and Germany, also some defensive cases that were brought in the UK. What Google wanted to do, what Google said it wanted to do when it announced this deal in the summer, was to protect Android. Now, if Google wants to protect Android, it definitely has to litigate in response to litigation brought by a company like Apple against Samsung, HTC, Motorola, and maybe others in the future. At the same time, certainly Google's acquisition of Motorola is now going to further exacerbate the situation. These battles are already pretty acrimonious and have escalated to quite some extent, and that's just going to get worse now.
So Google is buying Motorola, it says, pretty much to get all these patents. How can it use those to protect Android, given that Microsoft and Apple are suing the handset manufacturers individually? I mean, can it spread one patent around lots of companies at once?
What Google could do is it could either give smaller allotments of patents to different companies. It has, for example, in the past, given some patents to HTC, including even one or more Motorola patents, but those were unrelated to this deal. They related to a much earlier deal. That is one way of handling it. On the other hand, really Motorola's portfolio isn't so strong that they have a huge number of powerful patents with which they can reinforce the position of other Android makers. So what they will most likely try to get to is the point of what is called mutually assured destruction. They are going to try to put themselves into a position where they can do so much damage to Apple's and Microsoft's business, that is their plan, that they are going to be in a position to negotiate broad, comprehensive license agreements with those players that will take care of the Android ecosystem at large.
You know, by the end of the year, for example, what do you think the position will be like? Are we still going to be seeing all these this sort of crossfire of patents, or do you think that things will have calmed down by then?
There are three different ways forward. The first one would be the most likely one, in my opinion, which is that on the one hand, Google is going to use these patents to approach Apple and Microsoft and talk about license deals, but I think Google is quite likely, given its track record in this, quite likely to pursue a similar strategy as with Oracle, and that case is now on trial in San Francisco and was filed in the summer of 2010. Google has a history, really, of drawing these things out and seeing these fights through. The second possibility would be that they actually strike license deals with Apple and Microsoft at the earliest opportunity. If they try to do that, the problem I see there is that these other companies, these right holders, are going to want to get paid for their intellectual property. Google just promised, however, to the Chinese regulators that Android would continue to be available free of charge. If Google now had to pay patent royalties, then its own advertising, online mobile advertising revenues, might not be sufficient to sustain the Android business, so they would have to pass the costs on to device makers. And it's very hard to pass costs on if your product is free of charge. The third scenario would be that we see a dramatic escalation over the next 3 to 6 months, meaning basically between now and the end of the year. And escalation, I think, would happen if Google said, now that they own about 20 times or so as many patents as they used as they owned by the beginning of last year, that they are now going to really file all sorts of new claims, counterclaims, new lawsuits, maybe go to different countries to sue and just try to escalate this in hopes of that actually creating pressure on Apple and Microsoft to settle. That would be the other scenario. In that case, Apple and Microsoft, who have more powerful portfolios, would fire back, and then it would probably become disastrous. Or not disastrous, I think all these companies would survive, but costs would just be enormous and it would look like the industry is in chaos. So these are the three basic scenarios, and we might see one of the three or anything in between.
Florian Mueller, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles.
Still with Google, in the US last week, it unveiled a new iteration of its search results. If you type in a name or a place, you'll get a selection of results on the right-hand side of the page that aim to be a one-stop answer to your implied question. The man behind these changes is Amit Singhal, who joined Google in 2001 and rewrote the code for the search engine so that it, well, worked. I met up with him ahead of the changes and began by asking how search had changed during the 12 years he's worked at Google.
In the last 12 years, search has made great advances. 12 years back, search was largely keyword-based. Over years, we have improved search tremendously, that it's now meaning-based and user-intent-based, and at the same time, we have sped it up so that the time between your thought and the answer that you get has been shrinking continuously over the last 12 years.
And yet the sort of questions that people are asking is getting more and more complicated and more difficult to divine. I mean, one can understand that you can make it faster because you just have more machines behind it, but in trying to parse what people are putting in, how have you changed that?
So there are several key advances that we made, some fundamental scientific challenges that we have solved. One of them was, what do words mean? So, for example, Google understands that GM generally means General Motors, unless your query was GM tomatoes, when it means genetically modified. This is understanding in context. That's one of the key advances that we've made. And, of course, universal search was another huge advance that we made because it understands your intent. If your query is the Big Ben, chances are not only are you looking for wonderful websites about the Big Ben, but you're also looking for some pictures because it's such a beautiful monument tower out here. And so you combine understanding with user intent understanding, and that's how relevance goes up exponentially.
You describe searching for Big Ben. Mobile search is a growing part of your traffic. Do you get more information from the fact that someone is doing a mobile search than if they're doing a desktop search?
Well, mobile search is clearly growing exponentially, and it's been a great experience for us because we first saw desktop search grow exponentially 12 years back or 13 years back, and now it's, for me, like watching my second child grow up at a much faster pace. With mobile search, what happens is that relevance is even more important because you have limited real estate, and for the last 12 years, we have been investing in relevance with very laser-sharp focus, and it turns out that our focus on relevance has become the key foundation on which Google's mobile search is now built, and users are actually finding much faster on Google's mobile search what they're looking for.
But with mobile search, for example, you could get location information as well. I mean, does that availability help you in deciding what you want to do when someone puts in something like pizza or monuments or sightseeing?
Indeed. When users opt into giving us their location, we can do far more localized searches for them because, of course, if you type pizza or sushi, you'd rather be within a stone throw distance of a restaurant than several kilometers away. And mobile search gives us that unique opportunity to do that for our users.
You bought a company called Freebase a couple of years ago. Describe for us what Freebase does and why Google wanted it.
Freebase was this company, a small company at the time, which had come up with a unique way of storing real-world things or representing real-world things in a computer memory. Until now, most search engines are based on words, which are just sequence of letters and numbers. A search engine today does not understand that the Taj Mahal is either a beautiful monument or a Grammy-winning artist or even a casino in Atlantic City or your neighborhood Indian restaurant. To a search engine, Taj Mahal is just two words, and that's all they are. Freebase had come up with a way to represent these real-world things into a computer memory, and once you can understand things in the real world, like you and I do, there are numerous advances you can make. For example, if you type the query Taj Mahal, you can potentially give users a choice of which one are they looking for. And that, I believe, is going to be the next key leap that we would make in our search relevance.
So how much have you expanded the Freebase content since you bought them?
Yeah, over the last 2 years, when we bought Freebase, they had 12 million things, real-world things, represented in their database. And we have invested heavily in them, and we now have over 200 million things represented in our database. So we're very excited about the possibilities such a database opens up.
Things sounds very much like the concept of linked data that Tim Berners-Lee has been pushing very hard in the UK. Is that the sort of thing we should think of it as being like?
So at Google, we have to do things at Google scale. We get over a billion queries a day, and we have to answer all of them. And indeed, the ideas about real-world things represented in a computer memory have been there for many, many years. And wonderful people and researchers have worked on this idea. It's just that now we have gotten all the machinery together to do this at Google scale in a real-world environment.
I'm not quite clear on whether that's linked data or not, whether you think it sort of fits into Berners-Lee's idea of the semantic web and of being able to understand if someone says a race called the Indy 500, whether they mean a sort of race like the Chinese or whether they actually mean a car race.
So that level of language understanding is still some years away. But indeed, all of us, and Tim has set a great example for the world, are going towards the same goal of understanding what pages are saying, what people are saying, based upon real-world things like Indy 500 is a race, car race. And indeed, all these great ideas will come together for a far more superior search engine of the future, and I'm very excited to see what the possibilities are here.
You described growing up as a child in India, watching Star Trek, the original series, on black and white television and being inspired by that. How far away do you think that the sort of computer you can talk to in the easy way that they do on the Star Trek series, how far away is that?
When I started out as a researcher in the field, I didn't think I would get there in my lifetime. But now I'm confident that we'll get there in my lifetime. And now that may be 10 years from now or 20 years from now, but we are definitely going to get that Star Trek computer that I always dreamed of.
Amit Sengal, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Last Tuesday, Blizzard released the long-awaited action role-playing game Diablo III, just a decade after the last title in the popular series. Sadly, huge global demand conspired to smite the servers supporting this fantasy adventure. Thousands of gamers were unable even to log on, and the controversy only begins there. Keith, fill us in.
Massive worldwide demand for Diablo 3, this kind of modern adaptation of Gauntlet, the old arcade game that we all know, but with lots of RPG elements built in. And yes, it went online, the servers went online midnight on Tuesday and immediately crashed. And the reason why people are angry is not only because they were briefly inconvenienced by not being able to play the game, but also because Diablo 3 is the latest game to demand that users are always online. They always have to be connected while they're playing. Even if they want to play by themselves and don't want to play with other people in co-op or multiplayer, their computer's always got to be online.
Why is that? I mean, what's the thinking behind that?
Blizzard says it's partly to do with the game has a real cash marketplace online, so people can trade, buy and sell virtual goods with real money. And they say that's part of the reason it has to be online all the time. But mostly it's DRM, it's digital rights management. There's an enormous problem with counterfeiting of PC games and pirating of PC games. I think a recent survey suggested that 57% of PC gamers own pirated software. And some makers of games reckon at least, you know, somewhere between 40 and 80% of their PC games are pirated. The amount that are out there are pirated versions of their games. So piracy is a massive thing in PCs, more so even than console games. And so obviously, if you have a game which requires the purchaser to be online all the time, so it's always being checked out by the servers, then you've got complete control over who gets access to your game. And if there's pirated software that's trying to get online, if there's a pirated version of Diablo 3, it's not going to get on because it won't pass that accreditation.
So are we talking about pirated versions of a CD, copied CDs in effect, or are we talking about pirated as in a pirated key?
Both of them. It'll prevent either of those. And Blizzard isn't alone here. Other publishers are doing this. Ubisoft did it with their Assassin's Creed and with their Settlers game as well. It's not popular, obviously, because a lot of gamers see it as quite invasive. It means you can't just take Diablo 3 out with you and play it wherever you are. You've got to make sure you've got a stable internet connection. And I think a lot of publishers are obviously taking for granted the fact that we all have got super whizzy broadband these days. And, you know, the fact of the matter, a lot of people don't. And a lot of people have kind of quite interrupted broadband.
What sort of speed would you need just as a minimum for this to work?
I'm not sure if it needs to be super fast. I'm not sure what the minimum base requirements are that Blizzard say, but you need to have it sort of consistent. So if you were hoping to play Diablo 3 on a train, for example, if you go on in a tunnel, you're going to lose your connection.
Some people also have a problem where they log into the servers on the wrong continent, don't they? I saw our own Dan Cat earlier this morning talking about having logged into a US server instead of a European server, which I guess would lead to a lot of latency.
Yeah, exactly. That sort of thing happens. And Blizzard have been quite good in terms of turning over things quite fast. Blizzard are quite a trustworthy company. They know how to run global server infrastructures because they obviously won World of Warcraft, the biggest massively multiplayer game in the world. But the biggest problem, I guess, with always online connections with games is that not all publishers, not all developers have are as big and mighty as Blizzard. So you might get a lot of games that require an always on connection, but a year later when the numbers of users have dwindled a bit, who's to say the publisher isn't going to shut it down, and then you find your game is essentially useless. This is what a lot of gamers are worried about now. And really, always on is possibly, I would say almost definitely, the future of games, not only on PC but also on console. We're already seeing lots of Xbox and PlayStation 3 games which are more or less always online. They always have a kind of a social connectivity element. So although massive companies like Blizzard are going to be fine, are going to support their servers probably for years, some of the smaller companies may not.
Is there a sort of an implied limitation to how big their markets can get? If they're always looking only for people who are always on, that they're limiting themselves and basically shutting themselves out of countries which might have very low penetration of broadband and very slow speeds.
Yeah, but I think for a lot of publishers that's a hit they're willing to take. I mean, Football Manager, the big football management simulation released by Sega, they caused controversy last year when they decided to make Football Manager 11 available only through Steam. But to them, because there's so much piracy of their game, that they were willing to take that hit. They were willing to do that because the benefits for them in terms of ensuring a reliable income from that game outweighed the disadvantage of inavailability in continents like South America where the internet connection isn't great, but there's a lot of football fans.
But for retailers, it's a bit of a problem, isn't it? If companies start selling only through Steam, I mean, people like Game, which has only just managed to recover from a near-death experience, but rather in the shade by it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, lots of people foresee a future, if not in 5 years or 10 years, where bricks and mortar retail are completely out of the equation. Although companies like Game and GameStop in the States are trying to keep a foot in the digital market by selling prepaid cards with access to downloadable digital games on. So you could go into your local Game or GameStop and browse and see a card for a game like Minecraft, for example, which is only available via Xbox Live. And you might not discover that on the difficult and unnavigable Xbox Live menu, but if you go into if you go into a shop, you can find those games easier. So that's one way they're trying to stay in it. But yeah, I think we are facing a future of always-on connection for all games. And Diablo 3 points that way, and the anger that gamers have felt, I think, is possibly just the tip of a big angry iceberg.
One other thing about the Diablo launch is that scammers have been targeting the game, as I understand it. Just tell us a bit more there.
Yeah, that's right. If you're one of the many millions of people that are very excited about the launch of Diablo 3, and if you went onto Google perhaps and started searching for Diablo 3, maybe even some people might even be searching for Diablo 3 free, anything like that, you'll get hundreds of hits from scammers who have set up fake YouTube pages, fake offer pages to try and entice people who are looking to get this game early or looking to get it free. And these will download insidious programs onto your PC. They'll start trying to get hold of your account details, passwords, that sort of thing. But this is happening more as well at the moment. These great big kind of bandstanding game releases are often now being accompanied by massive global spam campaigns to try and catch on where eGame is out.
Keith, thanks very much. The role of technology in activism is on the increase. We've heard, of course, about the role of Facebook and Twitter in the Arab Spring. But it's also used for crunching data around environmental campaigns to demographic and economic statistics in the struggle to mobilise or influence policy. Increasingly, charities, NGOs and campaigners around the world are more and more dependent on tech skills to be effective. And this is where the Tactical Technology Collective comes in. The organisation was set up in 2003 in order to, they say, enable the effective use of information for progressive social change. To tell me more about the role of tactical tech and social change, I'm joined down the line by co-founder Stephanie Henke. Welcome to Tech Weekly, Stephanie.
Hello, thanks.
So tell us a bit about what the aims are of tactical tech and how you actually intend to get it done.
Yeah, tactical tech started nearly 10 years ago now, looking at how activists and journalists could use information technology more effectively. We noticed at the time that, you know, businesses were using technology, obviously, and it was changing the way they were working, but nobody was really looking at the NGO sector and activists. And the work we did early on was very much focused on access to technology, but that's really changed, obviously, over the years. And now the biggest concerns for activists are looking at how they can use information and data more effectively.
So what sort of data do you use? What sort of data do you think is actually effective in getting the message over? Because NGOs have been increasingly able at sort of getting their media message out through things like film packages and so on. What role does data have?
Yes, one of our areas of work focuses on what we call evidence and action. So that's looking at not what kind of messaging organizations can do in their campaigning, but looking more specifically at how they can use evidence or information to help people understand issues. And this, you know, sometimes we work with organizations, sometimes we're also working with individuals. There's been different changes in the way technology and data is used more generally that have really been, you know, it's been used as an opportunity by activists. So, for example, the increase in open government data that's become available, or perhaps not released by governments, perhaps released by others, like in the cases of WikiLeaks, have kind of opened up opportunities for activists to start using data that's out there and start aggregating it and using it to help people understand issues.
So give us an example where, you know, tactical tech has made a difference, where you've put some of this data out there and it's had an effect.
Yeah, recently we worked with a coalition, a group of different organizations who are working on looking at land acquisition deals worldwide. And they've been collecting just, you know, they themselves on their computers in their offices, collecting over 2,000 records of land acquisition, so where people from one country are buying land in another. And we helped them make this database interactive and put it online and make it so that it's something that people who aren't necessarily experts in the area can look at and explore by themselves. So by having a look at this what they call land portal, people can actually start to explore, you know, in depth themselves directly who's buying where and how much land in which country. And they can also look at the big trends as well. So part of our work is not just making it available, but making it engaging and understandable to people so that they can go through it and have a look at it themselves.
And you've also got an overview of data visualization tools. This is so that people can, in effect, organize themselves.
Yeah, and with the increasing amount of data that's available, if people want to start organizing it or analyzing it themselves, you know, one of the things we do is help them think about how to do that and show them tools that they can use to do that and talk about how to go through it. And some of the changes in technology over the last 5 to 10 years and becoming more ubiquitous and cheaper to use means that many people in very different situations are using these tools for all kinds of things, not just analyzing what's out there, but also maybe collecting data themselves or witnessing things. For example, around the uprisings in Egypt, one of the groups we've been working with has been collecting all the video footage that was taken by individuals. And then the problem you have immediately is they have something like 10,000 hours of footage available. And so how are they going to organize that and make it meaningful and useful to people in the future?
So does data help to sort of build the emotion around a story, or does it sit apart? Because, you know, the people will often say, well, you can interpret the data any way, you can use statistics to tell any sort of story you want. Is it more effective than emotion? Is it less effective? Is it something that only works if you can sort of tie an emotional story? Because after all, many NGOs and charities, you know, what they're aiming to do is to get an ethical change, a sort of almost an emotional change in people's behavior.
Yeah, I think some campaigning organizations do work on this emotional level, and actually increasingly we're seeing those things brought together, and that's why I think we get, you know, there's an increase in the way people make visual arguments that are more evidence-based rather than just emotive. So I think there's a sophistication, increase, let's say, in sophistication of how these things are being done. But the data is not just for perhaps, you know, making emotive arguments, perhaps it's for documenting things in the first place. So, for example, one of the projects we just released recently is looking at how people around the world are using these techniques often individuals, sometimes small groups, from a kind of ground-up level to do monitoring of what's going on. So, for example, in India, there's a project called I Paid a Bribe, which is allowing people to report instances of when they paid a bribe. And so it's not necessarily, of course, it's not a comprehensive database, and it's not something everybody would go through, but perhaps even the fact that it exists in the first place, a sort of independent mechanism for reporting things, might change the discussion or the debate about this, you know, this particular activity in society.
Yeah, I just wondered, do you foresee new ways of conveying this sort of data and information to the public coming in the near future? I've seen lots of NGOs and charities use games and other interactive content to try and make that content a bit more kind of valid and real for the public. I just wondered if you thought NGOs and charities were doing enough in this area, and if there was any way that they could use interactivity and social networks more in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the problems, so we have a project or give a series of talks called something like Beyond the 60-Page Report, which is a kind of, sort of joke around the fact that, unfortunately, one of the big outputs of NGOs who do extremely useful and extremely needed and thorough research, because many of the people working on it are more academics, lawyers, and so on, what they produce is a report. And unfortunately, this report is usually consumed by other people within the sector and doesn't really make it out there into the public. And if it does, it's not really something that engages people. So this is something that we see a lot of organizations really start to be concerned about, and they realize that they are even coming into competition with media organizations who are starting to cover their issues in a more engaging way than they are. And so if they're going to keep up in an environment where they need to engage people, you know, sort of consuming media in many different ways, they also have to step up the way that they're presenting information. And so we've had a huge demand from people asking us to help them or to help train them to find ways to engage people and put things forward in a different way, because the traditional ways of doing it aren't really working so well anymore.
Stephanie, you mentioned I Paid a Bribe, which is an interesting project in India. What's the next project you've got coming up that people should be excited and interested about?
Well, I just want to talk about the flip side, maybe, of using all this data. One of the problems, of course, especially when working in repressive environments or working with sensitive information, is as soon as you start using these tools and technologies for either coordinating with other people or for collecting information, you are also, you know, immediately opening up a door in terms of exposing yourself or creating vulnerabilities. And so activists that we've been working with, for example, collecting human rights data or mapping corruption, these people are immediately exposed if they're onto something. So one of our projects is looking at, you know, what the implications are and what the issues are of if you are using data for activism campaigning or you are using technology to coordinate with others, how people are increasingly getting exposed.
Stephanie Hanke of Tactical Tech, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And for more information about the Tactical Tech Collective, you can visit their website, tacticaltech.org. Well, that's all we have for you on this week's show. For breaking technology news night and day, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. But from me, Charles Arthur, games correspondent Keith Stewart, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, until Alex Krotowski comes back, and it's not a boys' playground anymore, it's goodbye.
Guardian Podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.